It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfort. Today, we're talking about art. The beauty of Alaska's landscapes and nature is a powerful inspiration for great art, and Steve Gordon's vivid images of birch trees and stream banks are among my favorite examples. They capture the light and grace of quiet places in our region of the state and somehow heighten the feelings they create while always seeming very real and never cliched. Steve is here to tell us about how he makes those paintings and how his many years of Boy Scout camping trips influence that work. Then later in the show, we're sticking with that same theme, hearing from a Boy Scout who went out on an outdoor adventure and had some mishaps, and learning about an art and science camp for adults in the Sitka area, where they also have famous art camps for young people. Stick with us, it's all ahead on Outdoor Explorer. Well, my next guest is someone I've known for a long time, and I know that a lot of our listeners know his art really well. Steve Gordon has painted these beautiful oil paintings of Alaskan scenes for many, many years that are just suck you in and just take you away to a place that you have dreamed about or have seen and is familiar. Just very, very gorgeous paintings of trees and landscapes. Primarily, and I'm sure other things too, Steve. Anyway, yeah. He's in the studio with me today because these are outdoor paintings, and also Steve's an outdoor guy. He led many, many Boy Scout camping trips, and that's where a lot of his inspiration has come from, and seeing different parts of Alaska. So thanks for coming in, Steve.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I want to start just with thinking about where your inspiration comes from for these paintings. And if folks who haven't seen Steve's work, go to outdoorexplorer.org and we'll have a couple of images that you can look at. Where do these pictures come from? Is it just places you've seen around town or around the state that just you want to capture this in paint?
Well, when I'm going out camping or on a hike out in nature, I take my camera with me on pretty much all those trips because you never know where that inspiration is going to come from. And so if I'm on a... occasionally, I'll go on just photo trips. Mm-hmm. It's not any other side interest, but just shooting the landscape. And you really have to follow your gut. And it's just this intuitive sense. If something's moving you or resonating as being beautiful or interesting or the kind of scene that if you had someone with you, you'd say, oh, look at that. Isn't that beautiful? That's when I pause, take a bunch of pictures from different angles, different light, hike around. And so it could be a dramatic lighting, the sky or the colors. I'm really drawn to color. I'm drawn to drama. I'm drawn to deep space and strong contrasts. I'm not particularly inclined to paint a cloudless sky, gray sky, right. with a straight horizon line.
Right.
I was always curious about what the North Slope would look like and had opportunity to do artists in school in Kaktovik. And it was amazing to experience, but it was solid, flat ice and the cloudless skies.
You're not Fred Mercatons.
And not a blade of grass or a lump or a polar bear or anything. And so I took a snow machine trip out there with my camera, but I didn't end up painting anything from that experience.
Because you're wanting to paint, like there's a lot of vertical in your pictures. So there's usually some trees. There's usually something that's standing up. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, we think of like sort of the classic Alaska artist is like sort of Sidney Lawrence, go out and find a picture of Mount McKinley and paint that. But what you're painting is just a moment. It's more like you might think of a French Impressionist of like just a moment, a spot. It's nothing special about it. It's just a spot that happens to catch your attention.
Right, right. When I first moved up here, I grew up in Iowa, so there's like no mountains. And the whole romantic Sidney Lawrence kind of landscape, I couldn't relate to and never painted a mountain for years. Because I want something that resonates more personally for me. I'm not into like the named mountain sort of landscape. Right. And so it could be, you could be in Anchorage and just turn 90 degrees and have this beautiful scene right in front of you. It doesn't have to be the remotest part of the state that takes 5 days to get to. And
yeah, I mean, you've painted Russian Jack Springs Park and Kincaid. I'm sure you've painted these places 100 times.
Right, right. Because I live in East Anchorage, so it's very easy to pop over to Russian Jack or Camp Blair Strip Road or up in the mountains. I couldn't really say that I'm looking for this one thing, but I take a lot of pictures, anything that kind of moves me at all, I'll take a picture. Then when I get home, I download all those and sort through them again. And it's the pictures that continually resonate and have a clear sense of place, light, kind of the sense of being there. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones I'm more interested in painting.
Well, you see, your work, one of the things that originally drew me to it is that you capture this sense of light, especially winter light in Alaska, which is very unique. And if you've lived here for a long time, you've gotten used to that. But at the same time, it's not like you're reproducing the pictures, because I feel like you, in some sense, heighten the colors. I mean, you find that sort of the essence of the colors there, but it's sort of raised to this other, maybe more romantic or dramatic level.
Right.
But it still is capturing what, and so it's emotionally capturing what I think of as that place.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not into my paintings looking like a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the particularity of a sense of particular place, drawing, space, the patterns that you see in nature being accurate or... particular, not just so abstracted that
you've got the right kind of tree, you've got the right kind
exactly.
of mark.
Yeah. I studied biology, that matters to me. But I love color, and so when I'm seeing color, I want to bring that out. And so before Photoshop, that was all in my head, just like I wanted it to. On one sense, be real, but have the feeling of my, how I experienced it more than just a photographic accuracy, color for color. Because a lot of people that work more photorealistically, to my mind, use way too much gray than what I would like. So, yeah.
So it seems to me that there's almost never a building or a person in your paintings.
Right. Because I like more just your experience with nature, period. If you put like any other element in, it can become even a small little moose. It's tiny in comparison to the whole scale of the painting. It becomes about the moose.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes about that person walking the landscape. And I like the sense of being away. And so I will paint out telephone poles if that's the case.
Right.
Or if a car is in the picture, I will paint that out because I want the viewer looking at the painting just to experience nature by itself.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times it seems to me that landscape painters will use a road or something like that to create the framing or the I'm struggling for the word, which is on the tip of my tongue.
The composition,
okay. Right? But it seems like with you, it's like tree trunks and a beach and maybe some rocks or something like that.
There's devices that you can use as artists to move your eye into a space, and there's like an artist's sense of when you're taking a photo or when you're looking at a picture, how your eye scans it and what makes it interesting so that your eye moves back and forth throughout the space. And so that kind of factors in like which composition is more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes just doing something that's unexpected, like totally flipping a reflected pond with leaves floating so that everything's upside down. But yet it's very realistic. But the way in which you see it is completely different.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So tell me about how you developed your style or how you, you're from a very different place. You somehow came to Alaska and fell in love with it and then figured out how you wanted to paint it. How did that story come about?
Okay, well, in grad school, everyone was working figuratively and it was very heady. And you kind of become influenced by the people around you and your teachers, what's being reinforced. And I didn't have a clear sense of what I wanted to say and do and my style.
And where were you studying?
In the University of Iowa in Iowa City. So when I got up here, I was glad finally when I got my MFA to be done with school, because you reach a certain point where you just know you're done.
Yeah.
And so we moved up here in 84, and I started just doing chalk pastels because I could pop up my little easel, hike in somewhere, and I've always enjoyed nature and the beauty of nature. That was a really core value as a kid growing up. So that's where I started. I just knew I needed to have a break from painting the model. And so that's kind of my exploration started with that. And from the pastels, and I went to painting on location with just taking a gesso piece of paper on a board. So it was very simple and really quick. So I would start and finish a painting in like a 4-hour block of time. So the paintings, early paintings from the 80s were much more very brushy, you know, more slightly more abstracted, very direct. Then I started exploring different scale, so working much larger, which required me to kind of work indoors. So I'd use slides and a little slide loop like you have like at a photo store.
Our younger listeners don't know what we're talking about, but yeah.
You could look that up in the history book.
That's right.
So that would enlarge the picture in my mind's eye. And so I was still working in a direct style, but it allowed me to work larger. And what I liked about that is that I could have the brushiness, which gives kind of an emotional and physicality to this being created over time and with energy. Because the viewer, whether you're conscious of it or not, kind of can read the kind of speed energy that goes into the marks and the brush strokes. And that, to me, makes the image come alive in a way that's different than a photograph. And so the larger paintings would take like a week to finish. So that was easier to do in the studio. So I started going, just working directly in the studio from slides. And then as, you know, people went to digital, I made the switch and loved it because then I could also tweak a maybe not so great photo and bring it to where I think it should be in my mind's eye.
Yeah, so it's this transformation process. Yeah,
yeah, it was all before I did that all anyway, but just now it's just a little bit easier.
Yeah, I guess as a writer, I don't know if I could write without a computer anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about making art outdoors, making art out of nature. And my guest is one of the very best Alaskan artists who does that, Steve Gordon. And you've probably seen his beautiful oil paintings of forests and streams and places around Anchorage that might be familiar to you. And if you haven't, you can check them out at outdoorexplorer.org. We'll have a couple images there. So you're quite the outdoorsman yourself. You've done a lot of camping and leading Boy Scout trips. And you were saying that you would lead a trip every month of the year. Tell me about that.
Well, I had friends whose sons were in scouts and just raved about, you know, winter camping, how awesome that is. Oh, my gosh. And they said, no, if you just get the right gear and they'll, you know. And so when my sons were old enough to do Boy Scouts, I had them join the troop. And I quickly became the person that planned all the trips. And it was really amazing if you have the right gear. You could be perfectly comfortable winter camping. And I liked being the fly on the wall, watching the you know, junior high, you know, sixth grade boys.
Oh, what a great opportunity to see your kids.
Yeah, you can see them kind of, because after a while, if you don't inject yourself into a conversation, you can
they forget you're there.
Yes. And so they have a lot of enthusiasm at that age for camping in general and being outdoors. And so that was great to like teach them skills so that they could, you know, after 2 or 3 years be competent to go on their own. And that was my hope for my two sons with the Boy Scouts. And so we've done building snow caves in Hatcher Pass, Turnagain Pass. We got this igloo ice box set up so we could make igloos, you know, by packing snow.
Oh, fun.
And we had quite the adventure one March in Turnagain Pass. It was a gorgeous day on Saturday. We built the igloo right at dinner time. It started to snow really heavy, and so we all went to bed. But it snowed like 2 or 3 feet overnight.
Wow.
And so some of the shelters that we built collapsed.
Oh, my gosh.
The people in the igloos, of course, it's perfectly quiet in an igloo, and so they woke up. They didn't know anything had happened, but the people that made the pit shelters with skis and tarps over mm-hmm. them were waking up at 3 a.m. and I was just
buried.
So every trip you learn something that prepares you for, you know, the next one, so you're smarter until you have like an epic fail.
Right.
Because of the conditions that you've never had on overnight, then you don't really know that that's a bad idea. Uh-huh. But I would always have my camera on those trips so that I could be at work, you know, taking pictures of the landscape. And I also documented a lot of just the boys, you know, as a chronicler. Mm-hmm. And then twice a year, we'd have slideshows of all those trips. And for the people that were on it, really, trips when you're in the outdoors are vivid.
Yeah.
Because there's a uniqueness that's distinctly different from your day-to-day life that's easy to forget.
Every minute becomes very much more real and
right.
And impressed in your memory.
Yes. Yeah. You can recall specific mm-hmm. trips here and there, you know, going back a lot years. And that's one of the beauties of camping. There's no electronics, no gaming. Yep. Everyone's in the same place experiencing the same thing. And you know, occasionally you have boys that aren't prepared. We had a shelter digging thing up near Flat Top, and the boys got soaked because of the, you know, when you're digging into compact snow, you get wet and then you're sweaty. And then at right. the end of the day, you know, if you don't have the right gear, then you're shivering. And so you have to work together as a team to kind of make sure everyone's okay, especially as the adult. And so that's one of the beautiful things with Boy Scouts is it's a good training ground, both for the parents and the kids to kind of really be ready to do any mm-hmm. kind of adventure. And what's neat, since I've stayed in town all these years later, you see the boys that were in your troop and they're posting on Facebook all
yeah.
their adventures. And it's like, yes,
you
I was,
yeah.
I introduced them to kayaking and now they're having a great
time. And you did like 100 of these trips. Or,
yeah. Yeah. 9 years. So
do you still get out on kayaking and
yeah. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just a little different when you're not leading a bunch of kids.
You have to make younger and younger friends.
Yeah, there you go.
So the people that I'm going out with are in their 30s now.
Uh-huh.
And so they're slightly older than my boys, but they could be, you know. And
we're yeah. talking about like Prince William Sound kayaking and skiing and snowshoeing in the mountains and that kind of thing. So exploring South Central Alaska.
Mostly, yeah. I did do the kayak. I mean, I was in Kaktovik and Barrow because mm-hmm. I wanted to see the North Slope. And I had a show in Ketchikan, so I got to see the Southeast.
Mm-hmm.
The people there, I was there in July and it was gorgeous, sunny. I had a little skiff to explore all the little bays.
Sweet. It is so beautiful there, right?
Yeah, and that was my only impression of the place. And the people that were hosting
200
me,
inches of rain a year, right?
They said it was the last time they didn't have rain was November. This was July. I mean, oh my gosh. That, you know, just totally shifts things. Like, mm-hmm. you know, if you didn't have that bit of knowledge in your head, just the scenery is so different with the rainforest, type of
yeah.
rainforest. And I'd like to get to other places in the state. And as the opportunity kind of presents itself, you know, I'm always up for doing a trip here and there.
Yeah. So it seems like because you're seeking beauty and you're seeking accurate representations of what nature looks like, mm-hmm. these kinds of trips would be really important because it's you got to develop sort of an intuition of how this kind of tree looks and how this kind of setting looks. Is that true?
It's to a degree. I mean, like if I lived in Kaktovik, I probably would paint the landscape there, but I'd have to really
learn
experience that for a while.
right.
The thing that's interesting with new places is it just each place has its own beauty, but some places it's harder to see what that is, depending on what your point of reference is. When my wife, who grew up in Anchorage, we were going to grad school in Iowa. We were driving across from Chicago to Iowa, and she burst into tears because she realized what she was not getting. But when we left Iowa, she thought it was beautiful. Yeah. And so it's that kind of, sometimes you do have to spend time in a place to really see the beauty that's there. Other times, it's just different, but it's beautiful. And it's just having an eye to see that.
But you've mostly focused on South Central because this is the area that you
That's
really
where
know.
I live, yeah. So when I had the show in Ketchikan, they were all paintings that to me summed up Alaska. They thought it was from New England because they hadn't been north of Juneau.
Right.
So their frame of reference is like
where
totally foreign. I don't
where
know
where birch trees come from, like, huh?
Yeah. So it's very that was an eye opener. I was surprised when they thought it was from New England. So.
Yeah, I wouldn't think New England because they're not so into the birch trees and the white spruce and stuff.
No.
I mean, I love that about your painting that I can recognize what species of tree I'm looking at and that it feels very local and very true to my experience of this place, which I guess is probably a lot of what makes it so popular is not just the beauty, but sort of the familiarity in the sense of, that's why I live here.
And so on any given day, if I'm ready to start a new painting, I have thousands of pictures to paint from, and so like, what do I feel like? It could tip one way or another depending on my mood that day, what I want to start in and try, but new places are exciting. So I'm looking to explore some new spots.
Do you feel like, you've been teaching art, you've been doing it as a professional for so many years. Are you still growing as an artist? Or, is that possible at this point when you have become such an expert?
I'm growing with the teaching. The one thing that's kind of a passion for me now is big murals and using that as a platform to bring attention to social issues. That isn't something that you could make a living at as easily, certainly not here. But it is important, and it's one of the roles that art can bring to creating a conversation about a topic of interest. And so that is something I'm looking very seriously at. It's sort of a new chapter for me, because when I...
No one would ever know those were Steve Gordon paintings.
Yeah. Well, I use artists in the schools and some of the stuff I do with my students is a kind of playground of creativity for me. Because I don't teach my class at UAA with the idea of reinforcing that everyone paint like me. I've had teachers like that where by the end of the semester, everyone's kind of adopted their style because there's such a emphasis in how the teacher reinforces a certain look.
Like, this is how you do it.
This is good. That's not.
Right.
And I try to bring out, I teach a beginning painting class. So the people that are just on the front edge of trying to figure out what they want to do with their work. So my approach is like trying to understand the person and what resonates with them, both in terms of, art that they look at that inspires them, and then try to help them in that path.
Yeah.
So it's a self-discovery approach, but I expose them to a variety of subjects, from portraits to murals, something that's more conceptual, something that's more visual. And so the that's what I like about teaching. It keeps it fresh for me as well.
Still grow through that.
Yeah. Because I look at a lot of stuff online and save things to my Pinterest board that I use with my class. And then with the social issues and the murals, just really starting to drill down a bit more what's behind the news that you read in the newspaper and how that's impacting people's lives.
Yeah. And I'll put the articles that I wrote about your class that was working on the opioid crisis. We'll put those on outdoorexplore.org too, so folks can see those. So you mentioned something that I find interesting and that I think a lot of us wouldn't really think about, which is in Alaska, you've got this opportunity to paint because you've got this incredible setting to paint in.
Right.
But you also have this tiny, tiny economy, not many galleries. And so there's some limitations to what you can paint too,
right?
You got to figure out something that a lot of people are going to want to buy, or you're not going to be able to be a professional painter here. Does that limit you, or does that influence where you're at?
It does and it doesn't, because I love nature, and so that's lucky for me. Mm-hmm. But if I wanted to paint something else, then keep the day job and keep painting what you want to paint.
Right.
And so it is a fairly small market. I mean, it's enhanced by the fact that you have one sector of the economy is highly paid and can't afford art, so that helps. But then you have the tourism, so that for the small size that Anchorage is, you have many more people coming through, and so it's a slightly bigger market than it would seem.
If you wanted to paint a picture of something ugly, you'd sort of like, that would not be
right. And so I tend to just paint things that I find beautiful myself. And you know, the trick to keeping things fresh over a 30-year period is that you have to continually and purposefully enlarge the circle of things you're exploring within just even landscapes, whether it's other places you go to, or if something is sort of a little bit out there that you haven't ever tried before, or whatever, that you continually do, you know, delve in and take some risks that way. Because I think if you keep it within narrow confines of what sells, that would just totally dry you up.
Right. Then you'd turn into just like a machine that's repeating the same thing.
Yeah.
So we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you if there's artists coming up, or if there's sort of a changes or development in the art scene that you're excited about in Anchorage right now. Especially on this topic that we're talking about, the outdoors and the nature and everything.
Yeah. Artists coming up. I've gotten to know David Pettibone through teaching at UAA. We're both adjuncts and we have classrooms right next to each other.
Oh, okay.
And I've really enjoyed his Year with a Tree piece. He's moving to Homer, so I'm going to miss seeing him on a regular basis, but very talented artist there. So I'm looking forward to kind of seeing what his next chapter is going to be down in Homer.
Yeah. I mean, as I think of, I go to the galleries every first Friday, and as I think about it, I don't see a lot of landscapes or Alaskan sort of beauty in what the people are doing in sort of those new. I think of you and Kes Woodward, and then maybe David, like you mentioned, but I don't think of a lot of other people doing that kind of work right now.
Not too much.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But, you know, so you have to be true to yourself. And so that's kind of, you know, but there is like when I was in grad school, there's a sense of an art community defining what's art and what's not art. And so the gatekeepers of, you know, culture could determine some of that, and just sort of a collective. Like when I was in Ketchikan, you know, that was a new landscape for me, and I could only relate to the landscapes that were coastal because it was the black and white of the rainforest, you know, when you have the light mm-hmm. coming through in the deep shadows, and then there's no edge to anything, and you're just surrounded with these huge vertical trees, you know. I had a hard time relating to that. I thought if it rained for that many days, I understand why a lot of artists from Ketchikan have more of a subjective kind of sense mm-hmm. of the landscape and more of an internal view of, you know, how they represent things mm-hmm. in paintings. So I think location does sometimes affect, you know, what a group of artists that lives there might produce.
That's a really interesting point, as you think of like Ray Troll and Yvonne Zurbitz and people like
They're
that.
They're very much kind of internal subjective landscape experience mm-hmm. and not so much about the actual observed landscape.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. Well, this has been really interesting. Thanks, Steve, for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great.
My guest has been Steve Gordon, who's oil paintings show around town. I should ask, like, where can people go to see your painting or buy one if they want to?
I have a couple galleries in town. Blue Hallman, which is in Midtown, 36 and Arctic. I have a show coming up there the first Friday of May that opens up. I have a show or gallery downtown at the Captain Cook, Stephens Gallery. Mm-hmm. And I've shown work at South Restaurant.
All right. Great. Well, thank you so much, Steve.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Our next segment comes to us from a regular series of recordings we make at Trail Tales, the storytelling event put on by Alaska Trails. We'll hear a story by Pierce Schwab about his attempt to win a Boy Scout Wilderness Badge.
I was a Boy Scout in Central Florida. Any other fellow Boy Scouts out there in the audience? Previous Boy Scouts, I guess. We love the Girl Scouts, too. Any Girl Scouts? Got some devotees back here. So that's what my story's about tonight. It's about my time, my very developmental time as a Boy Scout in Central Florida. Not a lot of great Alaska here, but Florida-centric. Anyway, the wildlife in Florida is much smaller than what you're used to here. We've got black bears for sure. They're about the size of large dogs, so not very intimidating. That didn't stop any scoutmasters from telling us the gory stories of young scouts getting eaten in their tents if they didn't brush their teeth at night. So that still stuck with us. We still had that fear of God in us. Anyway, 12 years old, we had sold enough popcorn to get us to Camp Daniel Boone in North Carolina. A big deal, big destination. As a Floridian, North Carolina represented the last frontier, right? Big mountains, giant wildlife, just surrounded in mystique. We were all gearing up for Camp Daniel Boone. It was going to be the highlight of the summer. We were all excited. My troop and I was part of the Troop 699 based out of Eustis, Florida. And we were part of the, I'm sure a lot of people from Eustis here. I was in the Flaming Sharks Patrol. Little backstory behind that. The Sharks merged with the Flaming Arrows and became the Flaming Sharks. Anyway, had a lot of good friends in the Flaming Sharks Patrol. Headed up to Camp Daniel Boone, all very excited. And we had one big goal in mind. There was this very coveted merit badge. It was the Wilderness Survival Merit Badge. And all of the older scouts, they had it. And they were total mum about it. They wouldn't say a word. We'd ask them, so what do we have to do to get this? You're clearly not old and wise enough to understand. So it was surrounded in secrecy and mystique. And so obviously when we get there, there's this big cafeteria and there's tables all around about the size of this room. They have the name of the merit badges kind of scrawled on paper there, and there's an older scout waiting at the table looking very intimidating. Well, we walk into the cafeteria, the far back corner, scrawled on a card, just the letters WS. And we're supposed to know what that means, right? It's this legendary merit badge. So WS, great, Wilderness Survival. We head over there. A very stoic older scout looks at us in silence. It's me and three friends. We're all 12 years old, looking very tough. walk up to him very confidently, grab the sign-up sheet, scrawl our names in. Again, older scout doesn't say a word to us. All he does, reach behind him, pick up four rusty coffee cans, and slams them on the table in front of us. We kind of take a step back. Okay, what does this mean? We don't know what this merit badge is about, but we want it. We definitely want it. So the only words that come out of his mouth, nothing comes that doesn't fit in this can. And then we'll see you at 10 p.m. on the last night of camp. Like, oh, okay, all right. So the whole next week, obviously, we don't do anything else but scheme what's going in this can. We don't know what to expect, but we have to do the right thing. We gotta put these right things in these cans. And so the original plan, myself, Kyle, Kevin, and Taylor, dynamic duo, or four of us, we originally have a plan. We're like, okay, let's think about this. Pierce, you're in charge of the shelter, so you get whatever we need to stay dry at night. We think we're gonna be overnight. All right, Kyle, you take care of the food, and then Kevin, you get all the water, and then Taylor, you get the weapons, because we definitely need weapons. So standard issue, pocket knife, probably 2 inches long. Every Boy Scout has it. Swiss Army, I have it to this day. But anyway, that was his job. So anyway, we had this great plan. We spend the whole next week scheming about it, fitting things into the can, make sure they fit. We talk to the older scouts. Of course, we get absolutely no information out of them. We're like, does this work? Will this be good? What happens? We don't know. So anyway, we get up to the right before the last night, and every man for himself mentality takes over. We're like, screw the plan. I don't trust any of you. I'm taking my own stuff, right? I don't trust Kyle to make sure that we get enough water. Kevin's definitely not bringing enough food. I'm taking my own stuff, and everyone felt the same way. So right before we started, in my coffee can, I had a roll of duct tape, a sheet of plastic, my Swiss Army knife, of course, and about 2 pounds of gummy bears. And I felt very prepared for this. No rope. What kind of Boy Scout doesn't bring rope? I was a terrible Boy Scout and never learned any knots. To this day, I don't know any knots. So don't ask me about knots, because I'm terrible at the knots. So anyway, I had the roll of duct tape. Have the can ready. 10 p.m., last night of camp rolls around. We're extremely nervous, but we have our cans with us. No flashlights, nothing like that. That would have been smart. Anyway, march up to the trailhead where we're supposed to meet at 10 p.m. very dutifully. There's probably another 25 scouts from different troops with us, all geared up to experience whatever happens at 10 p.m. on the last night of camp. We all have our rusty coffee cans in our hands, looking very sheepish, nobody's talking. Finally, two older scouts roll up. Fortunately, they have flashlights. Again, no explanation. All they say is, okay, follow us. So, all right. So we walk down this trail. I don't know. It felt like miles in total silence, total dread of what's going to happen to us out here. Again, a bunch of Floridians, and we're in the woods at night in North Carolina. Things are giant. We have no idea what to expect. So anyway, march in silence, total darkness. Nobody brought flashlights. What seems like miles, we finally arrive to a clearing. And the older scouts are like, okay, I'm going to give one walkie-talkie to one of you. We don't want to hear from any of you until the morning. Goodbye. They turn around and walk up. And so we just kind of look around. We all have our coffee cans in our hands. We're like, okay, I guess we need to like build a shelter or something. So we all get to work. Again, we had these great plans of how we're all going to work together as a team and build this great shelter, and that all fell apart. We were totally terrified. So we just scurry out of the woods, and I get my sheet of plastic out and my roll of duct tape and start trying to tape things to trees, and it goes really poorly, and it starts raining, of course, and I just give up. I said, okay, I'm going to wrap myself in this sheet of plastic. I got my gummy bears out. I was like, okay, we're just going to wait out the night, and hopefully we survive until whatever the morning. And I know there's huge black bears and stuff out here, so it was absolutely terrifying. One of those nights you never forget. Anyway, remember, one scout had a walkie-talkie. Some other lame troop, not the good Central Florida troop that was up there. We didn't need that walkie-talkie. Anyway, About 2 hours into the night, the older scouts show back up. They have their flashlights and they yell, "Okay, which one of you called us on the radio?" And not me, nobody did it. But they walk up to the scout they gave the walkie-talkie to. And he's like, "I left it with that group over there." And so they walk over to the other group over there and they're like, "We haven't touched the radio." And the older scout's like, "We cannot believe you guys. You said somebody was injured, and now we have to march all of you back." And again, we had been out there for all of 2 hours. And like, "Oh, no way, we were so prepared and ready for this. That's so disappointing." And so, of course, we all get up. I pack up my roll of duct tape. I'm covered in tape and stuff, and I get it all as well as I can, and we slowly march back. And the whole way, we're saying to our buddies, like, "I cannot believe that somebody did that. We're so disappointed." And all the while, we're like, "Oh, thank God." We were so terrified out here on our own in the night in North Carolina, just this terrible, terrible place. We get back to camp. Again, nobody said a word. We, to this day, we don't know who got on the walkie-talkie and saved us all. But at the end, we all went back to Florida. It was a great camp experience. We got our Wilderness Survival merit badges, and nobody said a word to anybody else about what happened that night. Thank you.
That was Pierce Schwab speaking at Trail Tales, the event in downtown Anchorage, which is put on by the trail advocacy group Alaska Trails. You can learn more about them through our site at outdoorexplorer.org. We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. And we've been talking today about the combination of outdoors and camps and things you can do with kids and art being a huge part of how we appreciate nature and the outdoors. And so right now I have with me Kenley Jackson, who's a program director at the Sitka Fine Arts Camp. She's joining us from Sitka via Skype. And they have programs not only for kids in the fine arts, but also for adults and some opportunities to mix science and art and some opportunities to learn about teaching art and opportunities to do it and see it and be part of it. And Sitka's like the most beautiful place in the world. I mean, there's nowhere that you could find that was prettier for experiencing nature and art. So thanks so much for being with us, Kenley.
Thanks for having me.
So the institution you're part of, the Sitka Fine Arts Camp, started out for kids, but now you're doing stuff for adults too. And I thought it'd be neat to learn a little bit about what that adult program is to start with.
Sure. Yeah, we've been doing kids programming for about 40 years, but parents have always been asking, when do we get to participate? So we have started an arts and science festival 3 years ago. And that's our sort of camp for adults, but repackaged in a way that adults come and enjoy Sitka and enjoy the arts and sciences together. So if you are interested in signing up, you pick a workshop. And this year, our workshops are focusing on combining arts and science. And so we've got a geology workshop that also includes some field sketching and painting. And last year, when we did it, included a geology wrap that some students were interested in. And we also have a writing workshop and we have a photography workshop. But the goal in our workshops is to also be thinking not just about the arts, but also thinking about sciences and really exploring Sitka with exciting faculty members. And we do a lecture series every evening. We've got musicians in residence. We do an excursion every afternoon. So we do a boat trip to get you out on the water exploring Sitka Sound, and we do a hike that includes musicians performing on the hike. And this year we're also doing a new one, which is a dock walk and getting to learn about commercial fishing in Alaska and fisheries conservation. So
well, that it's sounds a lot amazing. Of fun. Yeah. And it's, I mean, like a lot of us like kind of remember the fun of being at summer camp, that you meet all these new people and you're with them in an intensive way and you're doing fun and exciting things with them. And then, you know, you hit 14 and you don't get to do that anymore. So you're kind of getting to go back and have that kind of experience as an adult, which I think would be really fun socially.
It is really fun. Yeah, we have people that come from all over the country and all over Alaska to participate. And, you know, I think it's a time adults, a lot of us work or we work in the home and are used to our day-to-day routine. So it's kind of a chance to step outside of our routine and stretch ourselves in an area that's interesting to us and get to get to meet people along the way and be in an exciting new place.
Cool. So the Fine Arts Camp has evolved recently. It's been there, as you said, for many years. It's gained quite a national reputation. But now you've also got a campus where all this stuff is taking place. And used to be the campus of the Selgin Jackson College, which went out of business a while back. I was lucky enough to be down there and talked about it a little bit on the show, of just the transformation that Sitka has made to this campus with a lot of volunteer work and sweat equity and donations. And so it's really turned into a great venue for the kind of work you're doing, it sounds like.
Yeah, we are on the historic Selgin Jackson campus, and it was given to our organization in 2011. And we took it on with a lot of faith, and faith in our community and faith in Alaskans and our can-do spirit. I think we had the first year, I think we had about 30,000 volunteer hours that were poured into this place because almost everything was broken.
It was falling apart because that place had been, yeah.
Yeah, we were kind of the crazy folks that said, let's try this. And the campus has a really long history that's involved a lot of Alaskans. And so now we're reimagining this place as a place that will continue to be for education and continue to be for Alaskans. And we've got historic buildings, and we've got a rec center and a dining hall and dormitories on site. So really everything is right there. And we're also located downtown in Sitka, a few blocks away from the Totem Park and a few blocks away from downtown businesses and shops. And we've got an ocean view, which is incredible, and a really idyllic spot to be in the summer.
It truly is. Yeah. It's a good base. It'd be a good base also to learn about the community, which is so beautiful. So tell us about the Fine Arts Camp itself and, you know, what happens there for those who don't know about it.
Yeah, so our flagship program is the Sitka Fine Arts Camp, and that's the program that's been around for about 40 years. And we serve kids starting after their first year in kindergarten all the way through their second year in college. And it's an interdisciplinary arts program. And so students come from all over Alaska, all over the country, and a few countries every year around the world. And they get to experiment with different disciplines in art. So sometimes a kid comes in and says, you know, I'm a musician and I'm going to take trumpet classes throughout my day. But another kid might come and try a little bit of mime and try a painting class and try a writing class or Alaska Native carving and really experiment. And we're not a competitive program, so you don't have to audition to get in. There's no application that would say you can or cannot participate. And I think that makes for a really rich learning environment in our classes because kids might be really experienced with a discipline or might be trying it for the first time, but they create this community together where kids feel really at home with trying something new. And I think that's a really nice part that our kids talk about as being a special part of coming to camp every summer. And one of my favorite parts is every night we do a performance where the faculty are performing for us as a camp community. And so you're getting to see professional artists practicing their craft, and that's super exciting too. So we've got 1 week programs for younger kids and 2 weeks for older kids, and now we've got some specialty camps as well where we do a musical theater camp and put on a fully staged production in 2 weeks, and we have a jazz workshop and a dance workshop as well.
And you were saying that one of your adult programs is for teachers, which I know some of our listeners may be thinking, how can I get in on this? So if there's teachers out there, it's possibly they could get involved.
Yeah. So with our high school camp and our elementary camp, we use our camp as basically a teaching laboratory. So we now have teacher training institutes that we offer. And if you're a teacher thinking about getting continuing education credits, it's a really fun way to get that in the summer and in a really intensive arts rich environment. And so it's designed for both teachers who are arts teachers, but also teachers who are generalist teachers that want to learn how to use arts teaching tools to teach other subjects. And one of our really successful partnerships has been with a visual artist who's also a mathematician. And so she's worked with our middle school math program here in Sitka, and just using the arts as a way to engage kids and different learning styles. So we offer those programs as well for teachers in the summer.
Okay, cool. I want to thank you, Kenley. This has been really interesting. Kenley Jackson is a program director at the Sitka Fine Arts Camp down at Sitka, and you can find a a link to their program through our website at outdoorexplorer.org if you want to learn more, how to sign up, how much it costs, and all that information. And I personally, if this thing is cool, I really can't wait to get back down there. So thanks so much for being with us, Kenley.
Thank you for having me, Charles.
All right. Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. We're finishing today's show with something from outside Alaska, from Northern Community Radio in Minnesota. This segment comes from audio producer Milt Lee and his series, Call of the Wild, when he sat down with trapper Nate Jackson to talk about living off the land.
This week, I'll be celebrating my 70th birthday anniversary. Big O birthdays tend to make a person reflect on where life has taken us. It seems fitting that the Call of the Wild this time is with a young man who's doing a lot of what I thought I'd be doing in my life. Nate Johnson and his partner Emily Durkee live in a yurt, gather and hunt their own food, make baskets and tools and birch bark canoes, and generally try to live lightly on the land. But Nate was not always a back-to-the-land kind of guy.
Oh, no. I mean, we definitely had outdoor experiences, and we took some family trips to the Boundary Waters and had some miserable experiences getting rained on, the torrential thunderstorms, three nights in a row in the Boundary Waters. There's puddles in the tent, our sleeping bags are wet. Daytime comes and you get eaten by deer flies and the ankle biters. And, you know, so I wouldn't necessarily say they were experiences that propelled me forward into the life in the woods.
Nate grew up in Park Rapids. His father was a family doctor and his mother was a physical therapist who owned a local bookstore. After high school, he went to college and lived in the cities.
Yeah, I studied film and photography, which was more about, I wasn't sure what I was doing, and it was something that I enjoyed, not necessarily something I was called to. And I started to have this feeling like there was something that I had that I didn't know I had that I was missing. And that was that inkling and that sort of feeling that, what is out there? What is this? Is this my life? And I wasn't particularly drawn to the pavement and the vehicles, and yeah. Started learning how to grow food. Like with this seed, I was so nervous to put my first seed in a pot. I'd never done it before when I didn't know what to do. It was, what do you know, it grew. The basil seed grew. That was a door that opened up, the seed.
Was it?
Yeah, and like being part of life in that way. So that was a big door.
The big door led him to learn a whole lot of skills and crafts that would lead him away from the cities and into the woods.
And, that led me to be interested in handcrafts and building and food and then learning how to not just be a consumer. The understanding of the history of things led me to try to find my own way to do it here with what was around in a way where I saw what was happening to what I was doing. I'd need this, so I go out into the woods and get this, and I can be part of that process. I can make the good decisions.
Nate met Emily when they were both teaching classes up at the folk school in Grand Marais.
Well, we only bought this land 2 years ago. We just started looking around what can we afford, which takes you pretty rural. And we wanted to be on water, and we wanted to be around. We pick and sell wild rice and eat a lot of wild rice. And we like to hunt and fish, and we, you know, we get all our own food mostly. And tap sugar maples and do a little trapping for fur, for which we tan hides. And
this week, I'm talking to Nate Johnson from Dora Lake, Minnesota. Their land is near the Lost 40, an interesting bit of old-growth land that surveyors somehow missed during the logging days. They built a house, of sorts.
Well, we live in a yurt that we built, which is a round dwelling based on Central Asian design, Mongolian and the Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, those countries. And Yeah, so it's built to professional specs, but we cut down trees and milled them up for the walls and cut poles out of the swamp and built everything from scratch. Emily sewed all the cover and insulation together, so.
The yurt is warm and cozy, even on a cold January day. A small wood stove is camped in the center, which also serves as their cook stove. They have about 360 square feet of living space, plus whatever space they can use above their heads.
Yeah, we have 3 inches of, it's like a polyester quilt batting that we sewed together. It comes in a huge roll, and we got a bunch of that and sewed it all together. And we try to maximize all our space, so we have a couple poles lashed that go over the wood stove for a drying rack.
Some would think that this is a very hard way to make a living. But for them, each task is a unique challenge with its own unique rewards.
We try to do all the things that we need to do. So that encompasses food and clothing. And I do some tool making to make the tools that I use for my projects. And we do spend a majority of our time on food. That's the biggest issue because we do try to do not all of our food, but almost all.
Early in the interview, I realized I could do several shows on Nate's skills. Growing, gathering, tanning. But I decided to focus on a single skill. All that Nate does to trap and use the beaver.
We trap 5 or 6 every year, and we do it for food. We make a lot of beaver sausage and roasts and soups and things like that. And it can be good, and it's also like any wild game. An older, larger animal will often be stronger flavored and a little bit gamier, but we've just sort of learned how to prepare the animals. We trap with big body gripping traps, they're called. So the animal swims through it, and the jaws close around their neck, and it seems like a pretty fast way to go. In the winter, like if you come to our house or a lot of people's houses, we're like beavers. If you just come to our yurt, you would learn how to trap a beaver because you would say, "Oh, look, I can put a trap here or here or here because this is where they're always walking." And it's the same with the beaver. He basically lives in a yurt of sticks and mud and has his little roots to his feed pile and his little hideaways and nooks that he goes to.
Nate and Emily have chosen a unique path in a sometimes too busy world, and they share what they are learning with others. I may have tucked my wilderness and sustainable living books up on a shelf, but it doesn't mean I can't follow and admire what others are doing to live gently on the earth.
Yeah, we don't make a lot of money, and we live in such a way, we're trying to live in such a way where we don't need to make that money, and trying to eliminate the expenses in exchange for our own work, because it's ultimately about our time. So we can spend our time making money so that we can buy the things we use. But we've found more reward in spending our time to make the things we use and eat, and rather than making money.
With the Call of the Wild, I'm Milt Lee.
That piece was produced by Milt Lee from Northern Community Radio in Minnesota. And that's all for today's show. Earlier, we heard from painter Steve Gordon, Boy Scout Pierce Schwab, and Camp Program Director Kinley Jackson. And you can find out all about that, or even hear it again, at outdoorexplorer.org. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.